Welcome to Humble Brag. I'm Nate Mendel. Ever since October 7th, I've been experiencing a type of frustration related to what I observe online and what I observe going on in the world. And I've spent a lot of time analyzing, meditating, and trying to understand the root of that frustration. I'm certain that there are many people who can relate. For everyone, it may manifest itself a bit different. But something very large happened, specifically to the Jewish nation, which means that every single Jew has skin in the game. It also means that every single Jew feels a certain way about what is taking place. I don't think this event, the October 7th massacre, and what has been going on subsequently, is standard by any means. I think it's completely out of the ordinary. I think it was an extraordinary event, not the scale of World War II and the Holocaust, but it consisted of its own unique atrocities, its own unique barbarism, and its own characteristics that make it stand out. As I observe this frustration, a couple things become clear. The frustration is rooted in the notion that there is so much dishonesty taking place. I believe that the scale of dishonesty is at the crux of my frustration and the way I feel. In the first few weeks following the attack, we naturally felt that we would combat this onslaught of dishonesty and propaganda through regular means. We will dedicate ourselves to sharing the truth, putting it out there, and people will see the truth, and subsequently people will understand the predicament that we're in. They'll comprehend why we have to take the action that we're taking, so on and so forth. But what has transpired, instead, has only served to compound the frustration due to the fact that the response to truth being shared is the further digging of lies and conspiracies. So now we're dealing with multiple layers of distortion, and that contributes to more and more frustration. What started out, or so it seemed, as people simply not understanding what took place, has transpired into people seeing what took place, denying it, distorting it, and playing all kinds of propaganda games to discredit the veracity of it. We already saw this early on. At this point, it spread like a virus. A good portion of humanity has been infected with this virus, the anti-Israel propaganda virus, that by now there's no undoing it. I'm convinced that there is no antidote. There is no cure. For many weeks, I sat on the sidelines quietly observing what was being said, observing what comes up when I listen to what's being said, observing my feelings on the matter, trying to understand why I feel the way I feel. And all roads always lead back to one thing, dishonesty. When you know something is true because A, you've either seen it with your own eyes or you've seen the evidence, and you have someone before you who will say anything to discredit and not acknowledge that truth, there's nothing you could do about it. For normal human beings, that will make you want to punch the person in the face. What do you mean? I'm showing you the evidence. Dealing with this type of irrational profile, dealing with a portion of humanity that refuse to use IQ, intellect, to reason with, is extremely eye-opening. I understood early on, as October 7th was taking place, that there are some big questions here. But the questions are not related to peace deals. They're not related to solutions. They're not related to politics. The questions were right away related to ethics and morality. As you can hear in these excerpts from previous episodes, I realized instantly that people are focusing and talking about the wrong things. What is taking place here?
Watching the news, looking online basically at what's going on, it's really frustrating because it feels like everyone's just talking about the wrong things. At least two-thirds of the people, right? That's a feeling you get. In this episode, I want to talk about the right things, or things that matter. Tachlis, as we say in Yiddish and in Hebrew. The bottom line, or the purpose. There has to be purpose in what we're talking about. And right now online, probably 90% is purposeless or more. There's very few people talking about tachlis.
But as the weeks unfolded, nothing improved. The world at large returned to their familiar habit, speaking about, arguing about politics. And I sat and I observed. And I wondered, is there anyone talking about things that matter? What I have found is that, yes, there are individuals who understand which conversations matter and which don't. But as always, it isn't the people on social media. It isn't the politicians. It is our rabbis and our spiritual leaders. Once in a while, you can catch a glimpse, an inkling of truth from public figures, but generally they retort to politics. In observing this phenomenon, I have both answered my question. I also found the information that I need to sustainably move forward without frustration. After all, how can you listen to nonsense day and night and not react emotionally? The answer is as follows, and this is often the answer, not just for this situation. It's a klal, a general idea that pertains to almost everything in the public domain. The world at large doesn't care about truth. This is what's lacking in 99.9% of conversations taking place in the propaganda domain. Nobody's interested in truth. The politicians are not interested in truth. People on the right, people on the left, not interested in truth. But as a religious Jewish person, we should only be seeking the truth. The truth is godly, and we aspire to be godly. When you understand that a half or two-thirds of this world, maybe even more, maybe it's 80% of the individuals in this world are ruled, controlled, moved by emotion, not by intellect, not by wisdom, not by ethics, not by morality. They're moved by their emotions, and that they will never, the large majority of them, with some exceptions, of course, in other words, people grow up, they make changes, but the majority, the body, the movement of the world, the heartbeat of the world, will never be moved or directed by way of truth or intellect. You could begin to take a deep breath, because a good diagnosis is a half a cure. Now we understand the problem. Now we could breathe. There are dias, ideas that in the Messianic era, truth will be revealed. Somehow if Messiah comes, if Mashiach comes, and he brings the knowledge of God to the world, so on and so forth, maybe there will be some kind of awakening, a global awakening. But these are ideas that we can't really put our hands on. We have to deal with what is right now, what is real right now. And what is real right now is that the majority of the world, as I said, like the heartbeat of the world, the individuals, the collective heartbeat of the world, is governed, is active based off of emotion. And like I said, the body of the world will never be moved by the heartbeat of truth, intellect, morality, and that we should not even expect it, because the point of knowing this, learning this, understanding this, is so that we could free ourselves from potential frustration that it may cause, so on and so forth. It's not to try to change the world. You're not going to change the world by knowing this. You're simply going to understand the world. A very small portion of the world, of our population, really and truly care about truth across the board. Right now, the history of Israel, Gaza doesn't matter, but let's just pretend like it did matter. Those who really care about the truth and those who are intellectually honest, they're going to say, I don't know much about this topic. Obviously, the propaganda online is not here nor there. It means nothing. I'm going to open a book. I'm going to learn history. I'm going to understand this topic before I speak to it. Clearly, that's not taking place, right? Most people who comment on, who share rhetoric against Israel, most people never read a book in their life, let alone a history book about the Middle East. Okay, so the root of the frustration is directly correlated to our inability to see truth absorbed, acknowledged on a global scale. But once we understand that the majority of this world is not interested in truth, and that they never will be, and that the truth will never be accepted by the majority of the world, then we have a good analysis on the situation. We could take a deep breath. An aspect of surrender comes in, because we have to trust that this is part of God's plan, and that this is the way that Hashem wants the world to operate at this very moment, and there's not much we can do. And again, this is part of the frustration. Am I sure there's nothing I could do? The truth is right here. It's in my hand. It's 2024. We have technology. We have innovation. It's through the roof. You can't somehow give over this truth to the world? The answer is no, you cannot. Coming to accept that, allowing that to resonate, is imperative for mental health and stress-free living during these times. Understand something important. There is little to no truth taking place across the board. Choose any topic. Our enemy's biggest complaints. We killed more than 10,000 children in Gaza. Okay. I'll admit, for the sake of this conversation, that more than 10,000 children in Gaza have been killed. Is there something you want to add to that? Is there a question? If we were having truth-based conversations about ethics and morality, they would be very boring conversations. And by the way, the truth does exist. It's just sprinkled in between a whole bunch of BS, and it's hard to identify. For example, so many children dying in Gaza. Okay. So ultimately, they have to make a claim. So let's just get down to the crux of the matter. It's not moral, says who? How can killing 10,000 children be moral? Okay. So behind every complaint, you have to get to the crux of the problem. Two-thirds of what you see online are observations. They're not talking about the crux of the issue or what the actual complaint is. Israel bombed Hezbollah? Cool observation. Do you have a problem with that? Is there a problem with that? Truth-based conversations become very boring conversations for the world at large, not for intelligent people. So if you push your opponents into a corner and you don't run and hide when they're going to inevitably call you names, tell you how bad and evil you are, so on and so forth, the conversations go very differently. I've seen this numerous times play out on X. For the few individuals who will dialogue, it breaks down very quickly. And it usually finishes with them calling me a psychopath and a Nazi and this, that, and the other. Why? Because when you have truth on your side, you don't have to run and hide from somebody else's disapproval. I already know going into the conversation that we are going to disagree on the foundation on whether or not it's moral, because I've had this argument 100 times and it's going to finish that way. You're going to say it's not moral. I'm going to say it is moral. And then I'm going to ask you where you get your morality from. And then I'm going to tell you where I get my morality from. And it hasn't changed. Some individuals who are pro-Israel, say someone like Ben Shapiro, when he's pressed on numbers, now let me just be clear. A lot of people who are supporting Israel, they try to avoid the whole number conversation because you don't want to be insensitive and you want to be careful. And there's so many different reasons. Meanwhile, those are the exact conversations that should be taking place, that need to be taking place for people to understand. And so I've heard a few conversations from a few different people, for example, Sam Harris, Ben Shapiro, and a few others, where they said it how it is. Morality doesn't look at the numbers. In this particular scenario, the action that the IDF is taking, whether it's moral or not, has nothing to do with the number of casualties. Now, these types of individuals make that clear. It could be on a famous show like Piers Morgan, but nobody processes that. That is at the very fabric of all of this. That should be the only conversation, because if we could agree or agree to disagree on that particular point, then conversation is done. There's nothing else to talk about. Yes, 10,000 killed. Is there a moral conundrum there? No. Can I go home now? Is this conversation finished? Truth-based conversations are boring conversations. They end quickly. They're very simple. They're rooted in the Old Testament, the Torah. God handed down morality. It's unchanging. It's not going to change. It doesn't matter how much propaganda, cheerleading, and tantrums our enemies throw. I shouldn't even say our enemies necessarily. I would say low IQ jihadi cheerleaders, because that's essentially what we're seeing online now. It's not even Hamas cheerleaders. At this point, that entire segment of population pretty much supports every jihadi terror group out there. One of the things that I despise about news and media, working off the same example, Piers Morgan, is that through his modality of questioning people, he brings a lot of nonsense to the world. This is one of the reasons why news and media is so far from the actual truth, because inherently there's a conflict of interest. News should be fact-based, as though you're on a crime scene dealing with physical evidence. The people sharing news, the companies who run news outlets, they have a different agenda. Their objective is viewership. because viewership equals money, earnings. So how can you have an entire industry based off of profits be tasked with a job that is fact-based and idealistically unbiased? If you think about it, they don't mesh, but yet somehow this is how we get our news. When Piers Morgan has someone on and asks them, how many babies need to be killed before it's not okay? And that person responds with moral clarity that morally, the number is insignificant. Now, Piers Morgan, as a smart, intellectual human being, knows the answer to that question. He knows the answer. He was the one who asked it. He received the answer. But what does he go and do? On the next interview, he asks the same question. Now, I understand. One argument is that there may be new viewers with each video, so he has to play devil's advocate on each video. Number two is he just needs entertaining content, controversial content. He doesn't really care about the truth, because the more controversial it is, the more views it'll get, the more earnings he makes. But on the flip side, what you are doing is the opposite of truth, because you know the truth, you learned the truth. Instead of putting that to rest or using that response yourself as a truth response for someone who brings up the question to him, he goes and repeats the question over and over, thereby potentially making millions of people believe that it's a valid question. I've spoke about this in a previous episode. Large podcasters and news anchors and individuals, personalities, they have a bigger responsibility than they even know when it comes to things like this. Take the American soldier Aaron Bushnell, I think his name was, who burnt himself alive outside of an Israeli embassy while supposedly yelling. I'm saying supposedly because I didn't really look into it to know if it's true or not, but that's what they were saying on social media. He was yelling Free Palestine while he did so. I'm just proposing a theoretical. What type of Twitter, X, or social media channels do you think that individual was following where he was getting his information? There's a high probability that he was following some of the big names out there. If it was on X, maybe it was some of the huge propagandists like Jake Shields, Jackson Hinkle, or whatever his name is. Maybe it was Piers Morgan asking these types of dumb questions, right? I'm just trying to make a point. Maybe it was Joe Rogan, where he has a 3-minute piece talking about how scary Israel and, you know, being all dramatic, all this stuff. Influencers at that scale don't understand necessarily the consequences of sharing bad content. They're so focused on viewership and growth, they often completely overlook their responsibility and their part in influencing people. So when Piers Morgan has a response to his question and he knows the moral answer to it, he knows the truth, but on 50 subsequent interviews, he keeps asking the same question, how many millions of people did he stir? Because guess what? The 50 people that he interviewed post getting that answer, not all of them gave the moral truth answer. Many of them may have avoided it, as we discussed. So in between all his interviews, you could hear people who understand morality and they have moral clarity, they answer correctly. As I said, Ben Shapiro was one of them. But what about the 45 who didn't know how to answer it or who avoided it because they don't want to say something wrong, they don't want to offend anyone? What Pierce is doing is stirring up the emotions of emotional people to think that there's legitimacy in a question like that. You understand the depth, the scope of this type of phenomenon? And I'm just using him as an example. This is what's going on across the board. There are real ethical and moralistic answers to all the questions. Every talking point, every single news headline can really be reduced to the fabric of it. When they repeatedly put out the new numbers coming out of Gaza, which is not even trustworthy, but when they repeatedly do so, as if it's some kind of news breaking headline, 31,000, 31,500. Okay, it could be 500,000. It doesn't change anything. But when you're not seeking truth, when you're not having conversations about truth, all you're doing is involving yourself in this cycle and circle of entertainment, politics, political entertainment, propaganda, and frankly, yelling matches. I recently bumped into a short clip from Rabbi Manus Friedman that excited me, because like I said earlier, it's the rabbis and the spiritual leaders who seem to be focusing on the truth, not the people in the front line. I enjoyed what he was saying because he's speaking about morality and truth. And notice that these things that he's sharing are just boring. They would never make headlines. There's no fiery debate if you just get on and share the truth.
The world is upside down. It's completely.
Olam hafach ra'isi.
How come you're crying only over the Jewish kids who got killed? What about the Jewish kids are my kids. You cry over yours, I'll cry over mine. The arguments are just it's absurd. What is Jewish morality? Because the other stuff is not moral at all. There's nothing moral about it. It's pure nonsense. So let's take a look. Civilians. Are you allowed to kill civilians? Oh, of course not. No, you're not allowed to kill civilians. What's a civilian? Someone who surrenders. Guy surrenders to you, you're not allowed to kill him. Why? Mm. He's not a threat anymore. Why should you kill him? But if he didn't surrender, what makes him a civilian? What makes him a non-threat? Because he's not wearing a uniform.
It would sound like you're saying there are kind of no civilians in the situation.
No, what I'm saying is, it's not your responsibility
to
identify who your enemy's civilians are. They have to identify themselves, then you don't kill them.
So you're saying according to Allah, a civilian...
They self-identify by surrendering.
A civilian is someone who surrenders.
Well, or some other way of identifying, but...
Like when they cross...
I have to vet you and figure out that you're... I'm busy shooting at you, and I have to figure out whether you're a civilian.
Well, when the Israelis opened up a passageway for Gazans to get from northern to southern, they were walking with a white flag. They weren't shot at.
Mm-hmm. So there are two things, actually. If he surrenders, or if he's leaving, he just wants to leave the country. If he wants to leave the country, he's not a threat. But the point of it all boils down to, he's a civilian if he hasn't shot you yet? That makes him a civilian? What are you eliminating here? People who shoot at you? No, you're eliminating people who might shoot at you. You're eliminating a threat. You don't want to live under a threat. So before they shoot at you, they're already not civilians. If they're coming to shoot.
Right? How do you know if someone's going to become a threat or not?
That's right. And it's not your responsibility to figure that out.
It's their responsibility to choose whether they're a civilian or not, you're saying.
And identify themselves. Yeah. Even their babies. Somebody has to identify the babies as non-militant.
Well, what's
they're not being used as bait.
So you're saying a human shield is not a civilian.
That's right. The tool of war. Now let's talk about that. It's shocking. When two Arab nations are at war, nobody ever talks about civilians. And there are no human shields. Why? Because what would be the point? Only with us, because we keep telling them that we won't shoot civilians, now it pays for them to use civilians as shields. So it turns out that by saying we won't shoot a civilian, you've put every civilian into danger. We keep telling them.
So it's
not so, once in a while. Every time a politician gets up to speak, we are very careful. We go very carefully. We check with the legal system to make sure it's not violating any laws. Oh, good. Now we know what to do. And of course, the same is true with hostages. Two Arab countries are at war. They never take hostages.
Why is that?
It won't do them any good.
It's not an effective strategy.
It's not effective.
Right.
The other country is not going to give back prisoners.
Is there, I'm curious, from the Torah lens, is there any halachas pertaining to an exchange of threatening prisoners for innocent lives?
Yeah, there's a famous story of Mahram of Rottenburg, who was arrested. And they were going to ransom him, and he said no. You put every rabbi in danger all over the world.
And is that the correct mahalach?
Yes. How many people are going to die?
Well, you know, it's terrible what happened, but we do know that Yahya Sinwar was released in the Gilad Shalit deal,
yes.
And he's the mastermind of this attack. So unfortunately, in this situation, from the Shalit deal, we're able to know exactly how many people were killed immediately, which is thousands.
So even if you do intend to give everything in exchange for, don't announce it. Don't make it a negotiable deal or
becomes a currency.
Don't tempt them. It's literally you're tempting them to use.
It's incentive to kidnap Jews.
Yes.
Because they're worth X amount of Arabs.
All right. So with non-combatants, there is a halachic approach. You don't kill people who are not a threat. Makes so much sense. It's so moral. Nobody gets hurt. But this crazy interpretation that if he's not wearing a uniform, you're not allowed to kill him, which encourages them to, this is not moral. It's childish. It's literally immature. Now, proportionality. Is it such a thing?
Well, Israel didn't respond in proportion, meaning we didn't do to them what they did to us. We wouldn't, Israel is a real army. They would never do what they did to us in terms of how far they've gone with the atrocities they committed.
Oh, but we killed so many more.
And help Palestinians.
It isn't even an argument. It's like, just go back to school and learn something. So, it's so absurd.
So teach us, Rabbi.
What does proportionality mean?
An eye for an eye.
Sounds like, right?
Mm-hmm.
We killed 10,000. The world was quiet. 11,000, everybody said, no, too much. Oh, I'm sorry, we should have stopped at 10,000. This is so ridiculous. What is this, potatoes you're counting here?
You're saying when it comes to proportion, even if you killed five, if those five were not justified, then it's not proportional. Yes. It doesn't matter amount.
Right. So what would justify? If I can achieve peace by killing one person, then I'm not allowed to kill two. Why should I? The objective is to bring peace. And peace means your enemy is so intimidated, they will not try again for 40 years. That's peace. If they're going to try again in 6 years, you haven't even finished this war.
Where does that 40-year barometer come from? Okay.
30 years is also good. But not six. Six means you just didn't finish.
Mm-hmm.
You wait like 2-3 generations. The great-grandson doesn't remember the defeat, so he may have the courage to try again. But as long as they remember, they're not going to try again. That's called peace. It's a scary thought. Why was there World War II so soon after World War I?
Right.
With the same people, the Germans. You defeated them just 10 years ago, and they're back at war with the whole world? World War I never finished. Really, you shouldn't even call it two wars.
1A, 1B.
And why didn't it finish? Because the German army was defeated, the German people never felt the war. There was no fighting in Germany. Without the internet, without the information highway, the Germans could be convinced that they won World War I. How would they know? If the propaganda chief says, we won and make a parade, they would never know.
The riot is sort of World War II, Dresden, they felt it.
That's a scary thought. Had they finished World War I, there wouldn't have been World War II. And for us, that means...
finish the job.
There wouldn't have been a Holocaust.
Had they finished it. But what does it mean to finish it exactly? Because you can't just carpet bomb Germany.
We did.
In World War II, you're saying.
Right. In other words, you have to defeat the people who create the army, not just the army. If you defeat the army, they'll wait 10 years. The teenagers will become old enough and they got a new army, new and improved. So you haven't finished. Okay, so proportionality means if you can achieve peace by killing one person, don't kill two. If you achieve peace by killing 1,000, don't kill 1,001. But if you will not achieve peace unless you kill 50,000 and you stop at 40, that is so immoral because the 40 died for nothing. And that's your enemy, 40. And then you've got your own. All those people died for nothing because you didn't achieve peace. So proportionality means if you've achieved peace, stop. Not more, but also not less.
And I don't want to conflate for anyone this notion of peace when people have this idea that it's impossible to achieve peace with this particular enemy, of course, you don't mean peace, you know, negotiated at a table. Peace means the elimination of a threat. Peace means shalom and shalva shekhet.
Who came up with this brilliant insight? Well, you make peace only with an enemy. Who do you make peace with? With an enemy. Sure, after you defeat them. Not while they're shooting at you. I mean, the absurdity of these arguments, it's embarrassing to have to even, every Israeli politician, everybody, over and over answering the question, yeah, we are careful, we're very careful, we don't. And it's so degrading to stoop to that level of conversation.
This is what truth sounds like. Needless to say, from everyone's mouth, it sounds a bit different. You can perhaps be creative and turn this truth into content that would break some headlines, but that's not a simple task. I certainly don't have the capacity to do it. I don't know who does. I don't even know, you know, the people who have that type of influence, they're not interested. So, you know, I sit and wonder this myself. I have this information. I know what I'm talking about right now. And I have some creativity in the content creation realm. Yet, even I don't have the slightest clue how to make the truth interesting. Maybe in some messianic way, during the messianic era, there will be some creative individuals who will understand how to bring this truth to light so that it could start influencing the majority of the populace. But as of today, that's not taking place. And I think knowing this can help us make the decision to center ourselves, to refocus. It's not our job to change the world. The only thing that we can do is engage in more truth-based conversation ourselves. Instead of watching stupid videos online, try to watch some things that will help dial up your intellect, that will help raise your antenna for truth and morality. And in dialogue and in conversation, perhaps we can just simply try to be level-headed, understand that most people who are not busy with the truth are simply ignorant, meaning they're not viciously and deliberately being stupid. They are the embodiment of ignorance is bliss. They are truly ignorant on this matter. They are truly ignorant on the entire topic, so everything emanating out of them is pure emotion. In that regard, when you interface, instead of cursing them out, I try to just respond on a fact basis. It's boring, doesn't sound interesting, but it's just the truth. So again, I may stir up a conversation if I call somebody a piece of shit, ignorant fool who needs to read a book. But when I did so, I didn't share necessarily the truth. I shared my judgment of the person, which might be true, but it's still a judgment. It didn't help anything other than get some clicks and views. Whereas if I would just respond to the person simply, a genocide, and I'll just say there is no genocide taking place. That's a boring response, but it's a truthful response. Truth is boring. But when you have truth on your side, there really is no reason to get worked up. As I said in the beginning, the reason we get worked up is because we want to punch the truth into our opponent. How stupid can you be? The truth is right there. You share a video of Shani Luke's body being dragged through Gaza, and the responses are that Israel, that it's a fake video, or that somehow Israel, you know, made the video. You want to take that video, shove it in that person's mouth, and then take a toilet plunger and plunge it down into his gut, right? But there's no way to do that. When you're dealing with low IQ, emotional babies, this is the world we're living in. So the only thing we can do is rejoice in the notion that we are privy to truth. Now, if you're a person who argues, gets into conversations, so on and so forth, sure, share the truth. But don't let the ridiculous and utterly nonsensical stupidity of ignorant people get to you. I'm still working on this myself. It's been more than 4 months, and just over the past few weeks, I'm starting to get to that position where I can live my life and not feeling frustrated about the fact that a huge part of this world and society is derailed from the truth. on all fronts, but more specifically when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Another behavior that I find reprehensible on talk show, using Piers Morgan again as an example, is that the hosts themselves don't necessarily understand where their morality comes from. That's why somebody like him was using the term moral quandary from the get-go. He had no clue. Sure, the IDF has the right to respond, but up until what point? How many die until it's in? And recently he starts saying things along the lines of, you know, they're already going too far. Too many have been killed. That's the display of a human being that doesn't understand morality to begin with. Because if you base your morality on numbers, then your morality doesn't exist in that particular domain. So again, there are a lot of people who simply don't know what is right and wrong. As I mentioned earlier, the first thing I did was jump on these conversations with my brother, with Shoshi, with family and friends. It's the only thing I care, because the only thing that matters in this conflict is ethics and the morality behind the notion that we're going to go kill people now. So I found that to be an area of interest from the get-go. But how many people are online really care about that? Talking about utter stupidity day and night. This happened, that happened, the other. Shtuyot. But those who have moral clarity, they understand, they understood right from the get-go what war, killing, and all of it is rooted in. Because when you have morality by your side, you understand where you're coming from. It doesn't waver because it was a crazy attack. Well, it's truth. What Manus Friedman was saying is exactly the same thing that my brother said, and I believe this was within days after October 7th.
And if the purpose of the war, of victory, is victory over the enemy, meaning you have to define an enemy, and you have to be willing to vanquish the enemy.
The only conversations that matter right now, and the only topics that you need to understand and know how to answer, are as follows. What is war? What is morality within war? What's the purpose of war? And how can we conduct it? Once you understand that, everything else falls into place. The objective of war is victory over the enemy, as Yuri said, or as Manus said, to restore peace. Same thing, different words. How many people die on your way to getting to that objective? That's completely relative. I mean, think about the butterfly effect. Everything and anything could affect that. If a Hamas individual holds a civilian and doesn't let them leave their apartment and hides there, and then the IDF blows up that apartment, well, more people died than theoretically had to, because he, you know, the Hamas individual didn't have to use them as human shields, but he chose to. So now more people died. So the number is completely irrelevant. But understanding from the get-go what the objective is, and Israel made it clear. Let me say this. On October 8th, Israel made it clear. They said, this is not like all the other times. We are going to go in, and we're not going to leave until Hamas is eradicated. Thank God. Why thank God? Because this is the moral position. Thank God they stuck to their word. Because judging from their past, as Yuri in a previous episode mentioned, it's wishy-washy, right? He was skeptical. A lot of people were skeptical. So much political pressure, they might cave and not finish the job. So far, thank God, they've been holding true to their objective. And as long as they do so, they are on the moral side of things. Let's hope that they finish their objective. They need to wipe out Hamas. Oh, so I was saying on October 8th, they made it very clear. The objective is to wipe out Hamas. And so far, they've stuck to it. So with Hashem's infinite grace, they stick to it, despite temporary ceasefires, negotiations for hostages, so on and so forth. It was actually a really interesting conversation I heard the other day. Rabbi Berkowitz, I forget his name, where he was talking about the halachic ideas pertaining to hostages and ransom and all this stuff. It's interesting in its own right, but it's religious by nature. I don't want to get into it too deeply, but it was very interesting. There's also a divide amongst Jewish rabbis and intellectuals whether it's okay to make these types of deals. It's a bit of a complexity there, but despite all of the ongoing efforts and everything that takes place and how many people die, so on and so forth, let's hope that we actually achieve our objective. Because if they don't, and I said this in a previous episode, right after October 7th, if they pull out one day too early, then everything they did was immoral. Because that's how morality works. If you achieve your objective, if you restored peace and you got rid of evil, then it was a moral war. Your actions are justified. If you pull out one day too early and you don't achieve your objective, then the 30,000 who died were all for naught. So they have to. And in the rare event, I don't imagine this is the case, but in the rare event that there's even one Hamas supporter listening, there's only one way to reduce civilian casualties. And I'm doing the quotes under civilian because of what we just heard from Manus Friedman. The whole idea of innocence is a joke in its own right. As I was saying all along, define innocence. But anyway, the only way to reduce the amount of civilian casualties is if the entire world implores Hamas to return the hostages and to surrender. That is the only way less civilians are going to die. So all these Hamas supporters whining and crying about civilian deaths, they don't actually care because they're not doing the only thing that can make it go away, and that is to push Hamas to surrender. This is akin to the end of World War II when the Nazi leadership was coming to an end, the Allies were going in, and they were going to put a complete and utter stop and end to the Third Reich. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of German civilians were killed. So let's use history as a tool to learn if that is, and it seems to be a very similar situation, that was evil. The Allies came together, said, we are going to end evil. Here you have Israel dealing with evil. Israel says, we're going to end evil. All indications point to the fact that they're not going to stop. So then the only thing that could have been different, perhaps, at the end of World War II, would be for all the civilians to urge the Nazis to surrender. Not that it would work. I'm just saying that would be the only action they could factually take to save their own lives. And I don't see it any different here. The only thing the world can do to reduce civilian casualties is to push Hamas to surrender. Otherwise, unfortunately, more civilians will die as Israel inches closer to finishing their objective. How do we sleep at night, you ask? We sleep at night because we have morality and truth by our side. We understand that responding to evil and being evil are two completely different things. Let's pray for the restoration of peace. Amen.
Leave a like and subscribe. Subscribe.